trying to like.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jinx Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Welcome back, folks, to the segment number two with our interview with our good friend Bill Friedman from Nevada. He wrote a really interesting book. I suggest if you are a student of mob history, and especially mob history in connection with gambling and both illegal and legal casinos, you get this book. It's called 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. We're here with my good friend Aaron, the studios of the Big Dumb Fun Show. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, Bill, are you out there?
I'm here.
Well, Bill's back, and
we got Bill in by phone.
If I think the listener can probably figure that one out, Aaron. I think I forgot to say that.
We're doing a wiretap on Bill, actually.
We're doing a wiretap on Bill, yeah. I'm sick of wiretaps. I've been listening to wiretaps all week, man. Bill, you know, we kind of like to have fun here on the show. We've had people call in, and I had somebody email me and said, you know, you guys are like a comedy routine. So sometimes when it's just the two of us, we kind of get to going back and forth. You got to make fun of these guys every once in a while. Everybody takes it a little too seriously.
Well, in the last segment, Bill was talking about, you know, kind of the formation of the gambling in the United States as it was done by organized mob figures like Charlie Luciano and Frank Costello, and you know how the actual casinos had to come in, and when they needed somebody to do the job, they asked these guys from the mob to do the job because they knew how to do it. And at the time, I didn't say it, but I'm thinking, well, who else are they going to ask? The Knights of Columbus?
Really?
The only other people I know doing any kind of gambling are the Knights of Columbus.
The superintendent of the First Presbyterian Church? I don't think so. You know, somebody from the Catholic Church, they always ran those bingo games. That would probably be who you ought to get, a couple of priests that ran bingo games. What about that, Bill?
The bingo has been allowed in the Catholic Church across the country in many places where gambling isn't allowed.
Yeah, that's for sure. I worked with an old-time detective when I first went to the intelligence unit here in Kansas City, and at that time, there was no bingo in Kansas or in Missouri. The state legislature started working on a bill to allow bingo, and of course, there were several, the Catholic Church was among other several other nonprofits that wanted to get bingo established so they could use it as a fundraiser. And Ray Kenny was his name. He taught me everything I ever knew about being an intelligence unit officer. And Ray Kenny said, you know, Gary, once they get bingo in, it's just a downhill slide to casino gaming. And, you know, he was right. We got bingo, and it wasn't less.
Shortly thereafter.
It was less than 5 years we had full-fledged casinos. And now it looks like Las Vegas over here by the river some places. But Bill, you had a story that we might want to put back in that first segment.
You were mentioning the first mafia chieftain in Kansas City, Johnny Lazio, and the last book I wrote, one of the key areas of it was the history of the first five mafia bosses in Kansas City and their political involvement with Tom Pendergast. And I just thought you'd find it interesting that Johnny Lazio had a gambling operation unlike any I ever heard about in the United States. He had a casino, and half the building was in the state of Missouri, and the other half was in the state of Kansas.
The Last Chance Tavern. I know it's right down the street from my house.
Tavern. And he had crap games in it. And, of course, he had the police on both sides. But when they had reform movements, when the politicians had to look good, when the police department turned on them for some reason, all he would do is move the tables to the other state, and he never had to totally close down because he was always good on one side or the other, and it was just which side he would be working on.
Gary, you're saying that tavern's still there?
No, it's not there. No. There's a Quick Trip there now. It's right down there at Southwest Boulevard where 31st Street comes into it. That is state line, although it's not really marked real well, but that's state line. It's in my Kansas City Mob Tour app.
I was
going
to say, you should add that to your app.
It's in my app. I got a picture of the old tavern with the shows where the line was drawn right down the middle of it. And actually, they had the murders of the two Charlies, the Charlie Bonaggio and Charlie Gargano, and that was the last place they were seen alive before they went up to the Democratic Club up on Truman Road and were killed later that night.
Exactly. And what's interesting, since you're Kansas City, my last book, All Against the Law, Kansas City's only part of it, but it's a large part, and it has the history of each of the five mafioso bosses because in the different areas, they specialized in different crimes, and it also finally solves who was behind the Kansas City massacre and why it came off. So I delved very deeply into the Kansas City political criminal system.
I'm going to have to get that. We did a show with a friend of mine that did a film for the Union Station about the Kansas City massacre. So we had actually a two-parter, wasn't it? It was really
two or three, wasn't it? It was actually long
look
segments.
At it. Yeah.
Well, and I guess just as a backup, so people understand who you are, Bill Friedman, your book 30 Years Illegal to the Strip is just one of the books you've written. You also have another one you mentioned, which is All Against the Law.
Yes, those are the history books, and then of course I've written business books for the casino industry. I taught at UNLV a course, the Pioneer course in casino management. It was the first university level course in that subject. Today you can get a master's degree in it, and I'm the only person that ever operated two casinos on the Strip simultaneously. Companies may own many properties, but they always have separate managements focused on one property. And I was the only one that ran two, and it was for the Howard Hughes Empire Summa Corporation.
So, yeah, the Silver Slipper. I remember that Howard Hughes, that was one of the first casinos he bought when he moved in out there to Las Vegas. So you operated that? We were the management company that operated the Silver Slipper when Hughes owned it?
Yeah, I operated the Silver Slipper and I operated the Castaways. Both were long-term losers, and I'd never managed anything. I'd been a dealer for 3 years, and then I spent the next 7 years doing nothing but research on the industry. And I wrote a book called Casino Management, and they invited me for an interview, and they said, we know you've never managed anything, and we don't know if you're as good as you think you are. We've tried all the big names. They've all failed. If you fail, we're going to fire you, and if you succeed, you'll be our hero. And I was with them until the death of Howard Hughes under Nevada's state law. If there's more than one heir, you have to sell everything so they don't get in businesses. The heirs don't get in businesses they don't know anything about and argue with each other. So at that point, they had to sell everything, and that was it. But they were just marvelous people to work for.
Interesting. Now, I want to go back one more time. I want to make sure you get a plug in for your books, especially this All Against the Law, because you told me about that, and I'd forgotten about it. And that's got a lot of Kansas City things in it. And your other book, 30 Illegal Years to the Strip. Now, are those both available at Amazon?
Yes. If you're interested in 30 Illegal Years to the Strip or All Against the Law, print copy is available at Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com at $19.99. Both of them are available as ebooks at all ebook retailers at $4.99.
All right, great. Do you have a website?
I have a website. Bill Friedman, author, gives my background, how the research was conducted, and talks about what's in both books. And then I also do a blog there about my currently my promotional work, and then when I get into the next book soon, how I'm progressing with it.
Oh, are you working on one now?
Not yet, but I'm prepared to.
Okay.
Yeah, the next one in the series, I'm all ready to go, but I've just been so busy trying to promote this one.
Yeah, I know what you mean. That's a full-time job. You know, writing this stuff is one thing, but getting somebody to buy it and making sure they even not really getting them to buy it, they enjoy it. There's a lot of a big market out there, an insatiable demand, really, for mob information, mob history. But to get them to know that you'd see available is one thing. I'm on these Facebook pages that are mob interest, and you'll put something up about a book, and there'll be four or five people will come on and say, well, I didn't even know that existed. And they've been wanting something like that for a long time, particularly about Kansas City, because there's not a lot been written about Kansas City. I'm glad to know about the other book. I'll start promoting that on my my own Facebook page.
And also, I have the other murder I solved was the Bonaccio murder.
Oh, really?
And when I do these things, I think very different from a detective. But the other thing is, I do so much research. I have so much information in front of me that finally you can get from A to Z. You know, I use a lot of sources because I can go back into history that at the time the detectives wouldn't have had in front of them.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I think we did some episodes on the and talked about the Charlies and their murder there at the Democratic Social Club. Did we ever say specifically who it was?
There's supposition that
it was the Chicago mob.
But there's supposition that that's one way that Nick Civella kind of earned his way back in the good graces in Kansas City, because he was on the outs and he had actually hid out in Chicago. Does that match with anything that you learned, Bill?
No. It was a very complicated internal mob struggle, and it took twists and turns like I've never seen. You can tell why they're going to do it and also why they picked the exact moment they did it. I mean, everything just came to a head that night.
Well, these guys had taken a lot of money to open up the city and opened up the state for gambling and liquor interest at that point in time. And the governor that they backed, I think his name was Smith, and he kind of, as we used to say, he pissed backwards on them and did not allow that to open up quite like they had in mind.
That was obviously a problem, but killing him wasn't a solution, since he was the only person with the capability of ever making it work.
Yeah, that's true.
So what they were doing is like a loan shark killing someone who owes him money. He may beat him up, but killing him ensures he will never collect.
Never pay, will they? Well, let's get back to what we talked about earlier. I'd like to talk a little bit about
Costello.
Frank Costello?
I'd like to talk a little bit about Frank Costello. So let's focus in on him, some stories about Frank Costello. He was quite a guy. I was reading your book, how he was not, and you were talking about this the other day, he was not really the hardcore evil mobster that people like to paint him, and people like Lucky Luciano and even Nick Civella. Nick Civella was not... He would rather solve things diplomatically and get them done. He only resorted to violence when he absolutely had to. His brother was pretty violent, but Nick was not, and Carollo was the same way.
Costello, he abhorred violence. I was absolutely convinced it could never solve any problem, because any time you kill someone, they have brothers. And they're coming for you.
Yeah, that's for sure. We've seen that. We saw that in the 70s in Kansas City. It was three brothers, and they ended up, the Civella faction ended up having to kill all three of them, or they would have come back and got them.
My opinion, having studied all of these negotiations, a good deal means they may give up something they like, but they can live with it. The one thing he was convinced of is, if someone doesn't give up anything, peace ain't going to last, because the other guy will never be satisfied. So he was an incredible negotiator, and he negotiated his own deals, but he was all often called in to solve other things. And to show you the extremes he went to, we talked last time about the seven guys that led the three gangs, and to bring them up again, you've got one gang's Charlie Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Ben Siegel, Joe Adonis, and Vincent Hollo. And also in Manhattan with the big gang that just mentioned was Costello. And they were all very close, worked together. They all preached against violence. During the 25 years that first Luciano was boss of bosses, and when he went to prison, Costello became boss of bosses. It's unbelievable how much drop there was in gangland warfare. They were just very, very solid with this, but they were highly respected. They absolutely did believe in violence except in self-defense. They didn't believe in vendetta. And in my books, every one of these seven men had horrible things done to them. I mean, really atrocious things. And not one ever retaliated. They lived with this. And I'll give you the example for Costello. Someone wanted him out of the way. So one night he had a suite at the most expensive address in the world, the Waldorf Astoria in New York City, Manhattan. He was walking in after an evening out, and a man walked up and shot him in the head. And he fell. The man ran, and everyone assumed he was dead. The forensic doctor on the case said it was an absolute miracle. The guy shot at a perfect angle for it to bounce off his skull. Had he been slightly one way or the other, he would have been a dead man. When he went to the hospital, all he had was a bruise, and they taped it, told him the headache would eventually go away, and then the ringing in the ears would go away after that, and he was fine. If you believe everything you see in the movies, he has to go kill the guy who was the shooter, he has to go kill the guy that ordered it. Instead, when the trial came up, Costello got up on the stand and said, I don't know who shot me. I don't know what happened that night. I didn't see anything, even though the forensic experts said the guy had to be standing right in front of him. The guy was acquitted as he walked out of the... as Costello finished the testimony and walked past the defendant, the defendant said, thanks, Frank. And after he was acquitted, Frank Costello invited him to his home to have dinner with his wife and children to say, we've got peace now. We're not going to continue the war. A few years later, the man who'd ordered it was imprisoned, Sing Sing. Costello was so beloved by everybody in the underworld. Everybody in the prison was planning to kill him. Everybody was waiting for their chance to kill this guy for Frank, and yet Frank only knew 10 people in the prison. The rest of them were doing it because they so admired him. The warden couldn't prevent it with everybody out to get him, so he called up Frank's attorney and he told him the problem, and he said, can Frank do anything to stop this murder? Costello went up to the prison. He said, I want to meet privately with the man. They had a private conversation. They came out. Costello said, get a camera. And they got a camera, and he stood beside the guy who'd ordered his shooting, and they both stood there with huge smiles on their face. It was put up on a bulletin board, and with 24 hours, the warden said there was no further talk about killing this man. If Frank had given him mercy, they were going to give him mercy.
Well, that's interesting as heck. You know, and talking about that first shooting of Frank, it's pretty well known that there was a slip of paper in his pocket that had the word Tropicana on it, and it had, I believe, a six-digit figure, and then it had some percentages and some other numbers, and it was indicated that would maybe be the skim from the Tropicana.
When we get into Costello's career, he did more things in gambling than anybody else I ever heard of. But one of the things, he had a huge slot route. By slot route, I mean he had slot machines, a few slot machines, and a whole mess of retail outlets.
Is that anything like having a pinball machine route? You just go around and put the machines in and just go around and collect the money and pay a percentage to the local store that has the pinball machine?
That's exactly right, but he had slot machines when they were illegal. He also had incredible, elegant casinos. Well, his slot rod operations and casinos were operated by a man by the name of Phil Castell. And Castell built the Tropicana. Costello was the man who conceived it. He financed it. He was behind it all. Again, Castell was working for him. So there's no doubt in our minds that Castell was giving him a part of the profits out of his supposed ownership. But whether they were skimming on top of it, nobody that was associated with it ever said anything about that going on.
Yeah, interesting. Of course, you know, these mob guys, they like to have a little bit of fresh cash money coming in all the time, because there's in that subculture, there's always a need for cash money. You can't write a check to a city council member from the checking account of a mob guy. So they like to have that cash coming in.
No, I'm not saying it didn't, but I'm just saying that if it was going on, no one involved ever cracked up.
So the Trop, from then on, it was kind of known as a mob casino. And, you know, I've read things about in the 60s particularly, it was kind of it was almost added to the glamour, the je ne sais quoi, if you will, that little something special of Las Vegas that they had. I think Dean Martin once talked about how he owned a certain percentage of the Sands, and he said, I'm partners with five different mobsters, and a lot of them were sitting in the audience at the time. Everybody just was cracking up. So that was kind of part of the glamour of it, wasn't it?
Okay, because, you know, Costello was also the biggest bookie in America. He had the huge slot operations. He had the elegant casinos. He had the most glamorous and famous nightclub in America, the Cult of Cabanas. So, I mean, he really is a phenomenal figure.
Hey, I forgot about that. He started the Copacabana in New York, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he really had an impact. You know, I mean, he was the biggest bookie. He had the biggest slot routes. I mean, he really had an impact.
Well, I'm looking here on Wikipedia, and it talks about him being, during his retirement, known as the Prime Minister of the Underworld. He still retained power and influence in New York Mafia and remained busy throughout his final years.
No, he retired his Mafia position late in 50, in the 1950s.
He lived on out and died a natural death, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. That was the whole thing, except for Ben Siegel. All seven of these guys preached nonviolence. They always lived to their world. They're always negotiated fairly. And all of them, you know, there's a saying, you can't retire from organized crime. All of them eventually retired, except for Siegel. The other six, they retired, and they all died old men from natural deaths. Everybody said, you know, more power to you, buddy. Enjoy your life.
Yeah, here it says in early February of 1973, Costello suffered a heart attack at his Manhattan home and was rushed to Doctors Hospital in Manhattan. On February 18th of 1973, after 11 days in the hospital, Frank Costello died. It was his 82nd birthday.
Wow, he lived old.
Yep. And what's interesting, here he was the most powerful criminal in America after Charlie Luciano, when he went to prison, he took that spot, stood up to everybody, but as an old man, he was afraid to walk through Central Park in Manhattan because of the young muggers.
Well, that's kind of a testament to New York in the 1960s and 70s, isn't it, Midtown?
Yep.
Till Rudy Giuliani came along and cleaned it all up, so to speak. At least that's what he would claim. I don't know. But it was crime-ridden for a long time. And I've been to Manhattan in the last 15 years or so, and it feels pretty safe most everywhere I've ever been in downtown Manhattan.
To reiterate, we're talking with author Bill Friedman. He's got the book 30 Illegal Years to the Strip, as well as a second book,
All Against the Law.
All Against the Law. And you can find those on Amazon.com, and your website is?
And my website and blog are at Bill Friedman, F-R-I-E-D-M-A-N, author.
So these old mob guys that were involved in gambling, one thing I didn't hear you talk about, and I know we had a wire room in Kansas City, is horse racing.
Yeah, he also was the biggest bookie in America. Early in his career, he used to bet at the tracks, and he had a good opinion, and he would bet the horse he liked. And then to make more money, he would go take bets on all the other horses from all the wealthy people that knew him, because he expected to win when his horse won, and then he'd win from all these other people who had to lose at that point, unless they bet win and show, or a place and show. Seven guys that ran these three gangs, they related to everybody, got along with them. Costello was Italian. He married a Jewish woman. Phil Castell, who ran the slot operations and the casinos, including the Tropicana on the Strip in Las Vegas for Costello, was Jewish. And the man who ran the largest bookmaking operation in America for him was Frank Erickson, and he was Irish. And although Costello was the boss of bosses and certainly had Italian friends and certainly hung out with Italians, the New York Police Department, the FBI, the press, which had great investigative reporters in that era, they saw him socializing and in business primarily with Jews and Irish. And they not only didn't suspect him for many years after he'd resigned his position of being the boss of bosses, during his lifetime, he wasn't even suspected of being a mafioso.
Oh, interesting, interesting. That we get that in law enforcement, in which I was, of course, part of, we get this idea about how people are and how things should be, and it's sometimes it's hard to break out of that box when they've already broken out of the box. So I can understand how you could stay below the radar by doing things that were not what was expected. Pretty bright guy. He's one of these guys. I had an informant once who was a really excellent manager. He was a professional car thief. He had an organization of, shall we say, subcontractors that did things. We had some people that stole cars. He had some people that stripped cars. He had some people then took the parts, and he had a whole line of body shops throughout the Midwest that he was distributed him to. And I told him once, I said, man, I said, why don't you take all that energy and ingenuity and put it into something legitimate? And he said, you know, he said, it wouldn't be as much fun. So I think some of these guys, they put all that energy and ingenuity into being things that doing things that are against the law, because it would be not as much fun to do something with the law.
Just do it as a legitimate business.
Right. We have been here tonight with my good friend from Nevada, Bill Friedman. He is an expert on the mob and the casinos. We have gone way back to show the development of illegal gambling in the United States by the seven most active men in organized crime in regards to gambling. And as we've heard, learned some really interesting things and some things that kind of shoots down your stereotype about mob bosses, that they're all
violent
and killers, and they make you an offer that you can't refuse, as we learned in The Godfather. But I think many times they make you an offer that you want to take, and that's what certainly Frank Costello did with many people, and he lived to a ripe old age of, what, Aaron, 82, and died a natural death in New York City. And Bill says that he was, as he got older, he was even afraid to walk around the streets of New York because he was afraid he'd get mugged. And so it's not, you know, it's kind of nice to have, these are not single-dimension characters. These are multidimensional characters, and a lot of times we want to look at them as single dimension. So I appreciate your input on that, Bill. It's really nice to get that other view of mob guys. So I think, you know, having said all that,
definitely make your listeners aware of his website, which is BillFriedmanAuthor.com. It's BillFriedman author.com. And the book that we're talking about from Bill Friedman is 30 Years Illegal to the Strip, which you can get on Amazon, and you can get for Kindle if you'd like your ebook. And then we're going to get back together with Bill in the future here and talk about All Against the Law, another book that he has.
Okay. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Gary. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Check them out at oddomaticmusic.com.